Welcome to The Running Public with Bracken Crocker and Kirk DeWint. It's Tuesday, folks, and you know what that means. Training Tuesday.
We are going to take every rabbit hole, follow tangents, use useless metaphors, get lost in the weeds. This is Training Tuesday.
When you're ready to take your training or racing to the next level, go to therunningpublic.com. We have both monthly subscription training plans, $19.99 a month, and Bracken and I both offer one-on-one customized coaching. Again, go to therunningpublic.com and check out our offerings. You're on the right side of the ground today, Bracken. You look like yourself again.
I feel significantly better.
Good. I'm glad for you. I have a question about that. You ready for it?
Born ready.
We just had a conversation, I don't know, to start our podcast like a week or two ago about how you were really feeling good. And I think your username was like, maybe I'm fit or something like that. We had our training weekend together. Then you started really clicking off. And finally, I'm starting to click off a little, by the way. Now it kind of came full circle for me too, but you were gaining some good momentum, right? And then you got sick. And you didn't run at all last week, or you ran once maybe from your car to your house or something, correct?
Yeah. Yeah, I did one 1,200-meter run over the course of 7 days.
Because you locked your keys in your car, I believe. So, classic bracket.
Correct. While it was running.
So my question is, I've had a handful of athletes in this exact situation. I was in this situation in January. Like coming out of that, you felt really good. And then you're like, oh, I took a whole week off from being sick. I feel like I'm starting all over, blah, 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 that conversation. I'm just curious how you're handling that. Like, what is your approach this coming up here?
Well, I'm a rare bird, Kirk.
Oh, okay.
I am one of the only people that I know that doesn't care. I could go out and race in 48 hours with 100% confidence. Because I've had so many nonsensical things happen over the years prior to races or workouts that I've finally just lost all need for normalcy prior to a race or for a training block or anything. So I no longer have any fear about losing fitness because I've spent so long in blocks of losing fitness and realizing how things come back and hang on that I just don't get worried anymore. But I know it's still something that worries most people when they do miss a week. Like a week to me is like a brief yawn. I've missed weeks and months, like after surgeries and things like that. It just doesn't bother me anymore.
You have perspective is what you have. Not everybody has that.
Perspective and experience. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you wanted strategy. I believe you can jump right back into training if you want, but there are some caveats to that. And one is, are you truly over it or not? And I can't say that I am. And then second is, where did the sickness settle? And mine settled in my lungs. So because of that, I'm moving back into this with baby workouts. My frequency is starting as of this morning, right back to where it was. And actually it's going to be higher because I signed up for a race. I'm not declaring it quite yet. You and I can talk afterwards, and then we'll decide if we're going to document my journey to the start line or if we're just going to let me show up and see what happens.
The suspense. I think I know where you're going, but nonetheless, I think I have a guess, but I'm not going to say it on air.
Okay. I tell you what, if you guess it, I will just say yes.
Okay. You are going to go to High Rocks NYC.
You are correct.
That's right. Look at now you just divulged your secret. You had to do it. You didn't think I'd guess it, did you?
I thought you were gonna guess Anaheim.
No, I think you were gonna be a little further out than that. I love it. But let's not dwell on that right now.
Yeah, June 1st.
You're not committing to anything. Let's continue with your plan post sickness.
Yeah, so I'm getting right into the training block, as it were, but I'm starting it like 2 weeks in advance, I would say. And I'm doing like a 50% week and a 75% week and then hitting a full 9 weeks. Sure. So if it were a 9 week plan, which it is, whatever week one is bumped back 2 weeks. And I'm starting with 50% of that, 100% of the frequency, 50% of the intensity. And I'm going to let volume be what it is. So like today I have a lift that I've already completed and I have a run to do. The lift went fine. It was lifting feels okay. Like I felt weak, but not going to blow my lungs apart. and then the run's going to be running at an easy intensity, or I'd like to get 40 to 60 minutes, but I'm pulling the plug as soon as I feel like it's taxing. And then the workout first quality session will be tomorrow. I'm going to be hitting threshold intervals, but instead of doing my 10 by 3 minutes, I'm going to do 90 second intervals, and I'm going to try to build up to the same amount of volume, but I'm pulling the plug the second I feel like my lungs are straining a little bit. So just baby workouts, and then next week will be a little bit of a bigger boy pants, and then finally the real adult pants go on.
Yeah, adult pants are the good pants to be putting on if you're going to put on pants at all, yeah. I would say. So you're saying 10 by 3 minutes translated to 20 by 90 seconds, potentially, if you're feeling, to get the same
with the goal
volume.
To hit 10 of them.
Yeah. Oh, hit 10. Yeah. Okay,
if I can
20.
Hit 10 by 90, I'm happy. 50% weak. Anything above that is just pure benefit, but I'm pulling the plug before I notice an issue, if possible.
Yeah, see, I tend to try to hit my workouts as I would, but I just back off my pacing or expectations, allow grace. So if I had it, I probably would do the 3 minutes, but I would be like, okay, I'm going to be 20 seconds per mile slower than I probably think I could be, and at least start there. And then I'll just pull the plug on reps if it's really obviously going poorly. But either way, it's kind of, we're scaling the versions the same way. I think it's important to like prove to yourself a couple times before a quality after getting sick that, like, hey, I'm handling this, as in like a recovery bike or a recovery run, a handful of those. People tend to feel like they need to make up for lost time by, like, as soon as they're on the right side of the earth with their sickness, they're like, I'm going to go rip. I missed 2 quality sessions in a long run and I got to get right back into it. It's such the wrong approach because it just pushes you back further. It really does. It's way better to play the smart game. Either your approach, tempering your enthusiasm with volume intensity, but for sure preceding with a few easy efforts to like to verify you're ready for anything. I think that's the thing. And you don't lose fitness that quick, by the way, folks. What's going to happen is you're going to jump back into running. You're probably going to feel a little clunky, which is normal. Once you get into the workout, you might feel a little inefficient. You're going to take some pounding, and you hadn't taken pounding for a week, so you're going to be a little beat up from the effort. Plus, you still probably have a little bit of sickness in you. And you're going to get back for about 7 to 10 days, and you'll be like, oh man, I lost so much. I don't feel like myself. And then after you adapt to that initial impact again, about 10 to 14 days after you're back into training consistently, you feel like yourself again. You realize, I haven't lost anything. I'm about who I was before. Not all is lost. That's what I find. Is give yourself 2 weeks and you're going to be pick up right where you left off. No problem.
Yeah. Yeah. That's my hope.
Yeah.
And I did a little test run Saturday in the morning. I did 3 by 10 minutes on the treadmill at the effort pace of 9 minutes per mile. Mm. Like pure recovery run pace in the morning. And then in the evening, I did a 3.25 mile run at what I would call aerobic threshold. I just did nasal breathing. To me, that's my test for my lungs. Nasal breathing does not let you destroy your lungs.
If you can breathe through your nose.
Right. And I was to the, it was at night. It was that cool, crisp air. I was able to blow my nose for like 3 minutes before starting the run, get everything out. And then it allowed me to breathe through my nose. But it's such a limiter that I can't hurt my lungs doing that. And I would just consider that right around aerobic threshold. So working not hard, but not slow. And it was a good test getting done, not having a huge coughing fit, but realizing I feel like I was wearing a weight vest. So it's a good cautionary run heading into this week. And then I have 2 weeks built in, but staying open that if it scales down to a week, that's fine. If tomorrow's workout is a 50% workout and I feel so much better by Thursday that I do a 75% workout, then next week I can start in on 100 already. But yeah, just, I'm not worried about losing fitness anymore. Like, I got to lose 3 weeks before I even start to second guess anything.
Right. A week is literally nothing. It really, especially if you've been consistent prior. If you've been patch jobbing your fitness for weeks and missing here and there, and then that happens, different story. But if you've been consistent, it's literally not even it's a molehill, if anything.
It's a blip.
Blip. Let's pivot. Let's pivot to the World Indoor Championships that happened this past weekend. I watched those videos on NBC Sports, just on YouTube. They uploaded all the championship races to their YouTube channel, NBC Sports. You can find them. Watched them as soon as they popped up. And then again on the assault bike this morning, I watched all of them again. So I've watched every distance race, 400 meters and on, twice. And the U.S. had quite a showing. It was impressive across the board.
Yeah. I don't want to spoil things because long distance racing loses a bit of its luster for people who aren't diehards if they know the result. So I'm not going to spoil it, but this was probably the most fun indoor world championship I've ever watched in terms of races not going to form. Every race had a different strategy. Every race had a different pacing. Every race had you know, people that shouldn't even make the final up in there pushing for the win. It was it was parody, I would say, at its highest form.
We can't, well, you sure we can't spoil? I mean, the little show icons say what happens when they click on it. So you know when you click on it. At least the NBC Sports ones do. So, I mean,
I watched on Peacock, and yesterday we went to a Milwaukee Admirals game because Ayla was part of a group singing the national anthem, and it was right during the 1500 and the 800. So I came back and watched it after, avoided spoilers, and Peacock does not give spoilers. So watch that whole thing. So I don't want to spoil. If you want to spoil, I'm not going to stop. I'm not going to spoil your spoiling, but I will just finish by saying it was such good racing and some examples of horrible racing and strategy. Every race, someone blew the race by just needlessly wasting energy. Crazy to see it happen at the highest level.
That or giving up the inside, like things that rookies would do.
Yeah.
Like who gives up the inside anymore in like an 800 meters? Like when do you do that? Why would you ever do that? I did have a question. It was interesting. You know, the whole like frickin' back pushing and butt tapping in the relays at the exchange. I've never witnessed that before. What's the reasoning behind this? So what happens is people are waiting to get the baton from the previous athlete. I'm explaining this to the listener so they understand. And they're all in a line. The team that's in first, they're at next athlete is first in line, and then they're second, and you're in a row on the track. So you're all standing facing each other, or like facing the person's back in front of you, in order of which place your team is in. And the Dutch athletes, I think it was the Belgian athletes, were just on the U.S.
Belgian.
That's my, I'm Belgian. It's our fault, I guess. But just, I mean, like pushing him to the point where he was off his balance and they're fiddling around with each other's hands. It was really bizarre. What, do you know the reasoning behind that?
Yeah.
What? Why, and why is it legal?
Yeah, that was just creating space. So it was something you see a lot. The natural tendency during a relay handoff exchange is you're facing the inside of the track and your runner's coming through and you start backing out as you start accelerating to give your runner space to come in and give you a clean handoff. And that backs up the line behind you. And it's like a traffic jam. There's a chain reaction and people get pinched off and they get bad handoffs and get clipped from behind. So if you watch the US runner, their heels were already into lane two as they were standing there, which means if they take even one step back, accordion happens. So he was putting his hand there as like a buffer zone, and the US were aggressively moving
slapping
into it. And I've never seen the interaction back after that. You'll see people rest their hand as just like a parking sensor. But I've never seen the interaction after that. It was a self-preservation move, but then the Belgians aggressively reasserted their hand, and then it got slapped away like 10 times. It was wild.
Their exchange between 2 and 3, it happened, and between 3 and 4. The Belgians did it to the United States.
Yeah.
And I looked at the feet, and everybody's feet down the line were on the line. I thought the United States guys' feet were on the line, just like the Belgians were. So I thought there was an appropriate amount of space. Maybe I didn't see the shuffle in the feet backwards. Anyways, if you didn't watch this, you don't know what I'm talking about. It was in the 4x4 men's relay. It was like almost like little butt taps. Like you're doing something you shouldn't with your hands and you get it slapped away. It was just the weirdest thing. Anyways, we don't need to dwell on it.
I've never seen it that aggressive.
Bizarre.
The precursor to that.
Yeah.
I don't know if you watched the prelims. The Belgian team got kind of yanked around by an official back to third position, second or third position, when they were in the lead, and it almost screwed up their handoff. It was real. And I wonder if they just had a team meeting and said, listen, no matter what anyone does, we're holding our ground. And if we lose this, it will not be on a handoff. Indoor track, it's so tight and it leads into a bank right away. And they're moving so fast. I think they just went into self-preservation mode. Like, screw it. We're just making sure we look after us.
It makes sense. It's worth going and watching it just to see like the nuances. It's bizarre. It was a bizarre thing I'd never noted before in the
it looked, our kids were laughing, and my dad, we were all watching it together. My dad's like, what is going on here? I've never seen hand fighting.
It's bizarre. Middle distance US, holy smokes. Go watch. That's all I guess we'll leave it at that. The women, yeah. The men, making it proud, really putting their nose in the African contingency. Like, US, I would say, came away as the middle distance powerhouse of the meet, which is very rare. I think the most medals across the board, 400 meters and up, 800 meters for sure. Unbelievable showing. And I know there's a lot of big names that choose not to run indoors, and there's a lot of what ifs and who will be at outdoors or the Olympics. But if you want to be a proud American, folks, I think the Americans made you proud if you're listening from the United States. That's all.
Yeah. And if you could track, if there were like energy credits used during the race, and if you track the flow of it, I would say the US had the smoothest expenditure of energy, the most efficient race lines run out of any nation. And that, if that, there's only one way to beat better people, and that's to out-tactic them. And the US did every single thing in their power to have success. In fact, our most talented,
yeah,
highest ranked athlete was our least efficient racer.
Which one are you referring to?
Should be Nagus.
Oh, sure. Yeah, he ran really, he put it, doesn't matter, too far back. He did not position well.
Yeah.
But still fun to watch. Still fun to watch. So you can watch it back on Peacock, right? You can go look it up on Peacock, or it's on NBC yep. Sports YouTube channel. Just look up the World Indoor Championships. You have to scroll through a lot of videos on the NBC Sports page because they put a lot of content out there, but it's all in there. It's fantastic.
And PSA, if you care about not seeing the spoiler, you either have to have someone else choose the video for you, or you have to squint your eyes and just try to read the words and not see the picture, because all they do is post. Sometimes in the title, they'll say who won, and every time they show the winner crossing the line. I don't know why they do that, but you got to be careful.
Yeah, you do. Let's pivot to what we're going to teach the folks about today. Today, we're going to talk about something. I don't know if people waffle over this or not. If, you know, as a coach, I constantly feel like we fight this battle with athletes. It probably will be till the end of time, as long as we're coaching. But the simple conversation of how often should I race? Like, I think what I would like to do with that conversation is, how often should I race to perform my best? I think would be the starting point. And then if we want to chat out the caveats or the I got to race for my sanity people or whatever it is.
Yep.
But are you cool with starting it with how often should I race to race my best?
Yes.
What do you think?
Yeah. And I'm going to start with just the performance standpoint, not racing for health, not racing for sanity, just purely X's and O's of racing.
Yep.
I think that there's a spectrum from fast to slow. And the faster you are, or the slower you are, end of the spectrum, the more you get to race without it impacting your performance. And the more you're in the middle, the more you have to throttle and modulate your racing. And I'm happy to explain why, but that's my rule, that if you're incredibly fast or incredibly slow, go race every weekend if you want. But if you're right in between, kind of on the verge of one or the other, you got to be careful with your racing.
Floor is yours. I'm intrigued. Talk to me.
Do you have an inkling where I'm going?
Yeah, I think if you're a really high top performer and super well trained, your body can take that sort of damage stimulus and turn it around pretty quick. And then I think if you're on the opposite end of the scale, I think that a lot of times if you're going to use that as stimulus to propel you, if you're on the slower end, so accessing maybe top end isn't quite as available to you. So it also allows for more frequency. That'd be just surface level response to that. But I want to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, that's 50% of it. Then the other half is that the faster you are, the less you have to race all out to still feel really good about your race. The really, really fastest people amongst us can just cruise for a while until they feel like working. Like my first ultra I ran into Tyler Siegel, who was the 100K US champ at the time. And he tempoed it. He just went out for a good long run. He ran casually talking with me for 45 minutes or an hour. And then just picked it up in negative split all the way home. And that was a race. It was also a workout. And he also ran quality probably 48 hours later. He was fine. I was destroyed for a week because I had to empty my soul in order to make it to the finish line with a successful day. And his success was, oh, I won it with probably 70% effort, and I got to get a good workout in. So that's the high end of the spectrum. And of course, you're right. Most of those people who are that good are very high mileage. It's not that stressful and demanding for them. It's repeatable. They can recover from it well, and they don't have to go to the well every time. So it doesn't cost them so many credits. And then on the slow end, you don't get into the high intensity effort when you're really out of shape or very slow. It's more of a muscular damage you take because you're on course for a long time and you generally have slower cadence. That's the kind of thing your body can recover from in 24 to 48 hours anyway. Most of the time, you're not taking that cellular damage, that nervous system destruction that a really high intensity red line race will do. So you get to race a lot, use it as fitness builders. It's the middle ground, like me in that race, where I was just fast enough to be competitive, but not good enough to back off ever. And I was afraid of getting caught the whole time, but I also cared about my time. And so I just crushed myself and put myself into like 15 days of feeling like the Walking Dead afterwards. So the middle ground people have to race enough to stay sharp, but they can't rely on it as their only fitness mover for their training block.
Well, yeah, and there's a lot of nuances to this. Like if you're running 5Ks on the weekends or you're running 50K plus races, right? Like there's going to be exceptions to the rule. If you're an ultra runner and you're running 100Ks, like you might be good for 2 to 4 a year tops. And I mean, that's really pushing it. And you're going to be lucky. If I said you could only run 2 5Ks a year, that would be ridiculous, right? So there's of course nuances, but I think we stick to the scope of like, for the sake of the running public, 5K to half marathon, maybe even keep the marathon out of it, but just like most races that you're going to approach, right? Most races that last 15 minutes to 2 to 3 hours, right? Which is most of what you're going to be towing the line. I think for the sake of conversation, that would be helpful.
Yeah. 2 hours and under, I think, is a good cap for the average person.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think we go high level. I think we take a 10,000 foot view on this to start. I have what I think is a cadence that works well, but let's start from this 10,000 foot view. Let's say you care about every performance. Every race is an A race to you. Mm-hmm. I toe the line, of course I'm going to race it my all out because that's how I race. That's a lot of people, including myself. I rarely race just to go play with my friends. Like that's silly to me. So if you care about your performance, you want to show up ready, available, and fit for every race you show up at, what is the tightest window you believe you can race throughout the year? Let's say you were to keep this cadence the entire 12 months of the year. What do you think? What is the appropriate cadence to show up and within 95% certainty, ready to go potentially PR? What do you think?
From a recovery standpoint, you could do 3 to 4 weeks.
For a year.
You could race 1 to 1.5 times per month. All year, 12 to 15 times per year. I think recoverability, and again, I'm saying for the average person, there are the Ryland Chadigs, the Chris Roglaskis out there. There are the people racing a crazy amount. But for the average normal person, once a month, roughly up to 15 times a year, right around that time frame. But what you start to run into is disjointed training blocks. So even though your recoverability and your energy wise, I think you can keep at that 90 to 95%. Will you be at 90 to 95% of fitness by the end of the year? I can't guarantee that. That I look more like every 4 to 6 weeks for something like that.
Yeah, I can't argue with any of that. My answer is every 5 to 6 weeks. If you're going to sustain throughout the year, what you got to think about is, let's say you go swing hard. I don't care if it's a 5K or it's a half marathon. You swing hard. You have a transition week afterwards where you kind of let your body tell you what it wants. Then you have 2 to 3 up weeks again where you get in your long runs that are necessary. You get in enough stimulus. Then you have another week or week and a half to gradually come down into your next race, smack it, start the process all over again. That's just a 5-week cycle, in my opinion, if you're going to do it right and give yourself a chance to climb the next rung of the ladder. 5 to 6 weeks, fives, I think. And we're talking the same language. I do think you could do 3 to 4 weeks. I think 3 weeks minimum. But I'm going to say 5 or 6. If that was your cadence all year, what is that? What is that? 8 races a year? That's a lot of racing. 8 races you care about that show up and do well.
Yeah, we're talking A races. You could have more in there, but races you want to destroy yourself in.
Yeah.
It's, and we've, we've done the opposite. We both ran indoor and outdoor track. And think about what that meant back in the day. What an indoor track meet, you'd run two races per meet. You'd run the 800 or the mile or the 5K or the 3K, and then you generally come back in the 4x4, generally. So two a week indoor, and then outdoor, same kind of deal. So how long is indoor?
2 months at most. Weeks? Yeah, not long.
Yeah. And then outdoor again. So you're looking at, you could race 20 to 30 times in just a 4 month stretch. We've done that, but we've also watched ourselves and everyone around us really struggle to have to choose when you want to be good. They can't all be A races. When I first got to college, every race was an A race. Because I was an underclassman, and I was trying to make it, and I was hanging on in every race, and I ran like 9 consecutive A races indoor. And I got to outdoor, and I had 2 good races, and then everything got more and more tired after that, and I just couldn't do it anymore. Even though my training continued, and I kept trying to recover, and I did everything I could, we've done it. We've run 30 times in 4 months. It's a lot of racing, but it's not unheard of. But it's just not sustainable for a year.
Yeah, I mean, even in high school, a different animal as a 16-year-old kid. But like, you'd run 2 races on Tuesday. You'd run 2 to 3 races on your invitational Saturday. You'd run 2 to 4 to 5 races a week. And you would do that for months and months and months on end. And sometimes there were qualifiers. Yeah. It's like unbelievable how much we raced.
Yeah, you might run 50 races in a season.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Yeah.
Look at your medal count from high school. I got this plaque my mom put together for me for my Christmas 1 year. And there are hundreds of medals on there. I'm like, the number of times we towed a start line, unbelievable. And then college, it gets a little more manageable. Then you're like, oh, I only have to race a meet once a week. That seems like a gift in college when you transition to college. And then you transition to the real world and you don't, and not once a week is the cadence again. But okay, so you want to race well all year. Let's say you don't have seasons, right? You just want to race. I think we're both in the same ballpark there. What I really think people should do is kind of split their year up into two somehow in their mind. And I think it's okay to race at a cadence of like 3 or 4 weeks, like you said. And you can even end with a bang, race every weekend or every 2 weekends as like a finisher. You can get some really good fitness and really good racing fitness by just jamming them into sort of a block and then down, maybe take an off week and then build yourself back up with a month or two without racing. And then boom, every 3 weeks, blow it out with a bunch of races condensed at the end, start the cycle over again. And so when it averages out, it might average out to 10 to 12 races a year, but you might have 4 full months in there or 3 full months in there where you don't have a race at all, right? You kind of have a base phase, you race every month, you hit like, hey, I'm racing 3 weekends in a row. It's going to be awesome. And you probably could race very well and maybe PR and break through, but then you got to reset again, which I think is a better cadence for most people. What do you think of that?
I agree. I like that. When I look at my seasons in the years when, and I do this every year, I schedule out my season, then I have a surgery and then I don't get to it. But even myself, or when I'm not racing, but I'm trying to, I try to have a race per quarter or per trimester that I care about, and it structures everything. So a spring race, a summer race, a fall race that really, really matters. It drives everything I'm doing, and I will race along the way, but you approach them different. You're not really getting a taper week. You're getting back to training afterward. It's if I do, I'm still going to run as hard as I can, but it's not, I'm not building up for it. There's not a mental weight before and after. There's not a, I'm not really studying the course map. I'm going out there just to do it. And if 50 monsters show up or no monster show, it doesn't matter. I'm just going out there to run hard. But one per quarter or one per season is a really nice flow to a year. And then it allows you to not care about the races along the way to the same extent. And something about that matters. The hardest 5K I ever ran in my life happened on a whim. And I recovered from it very well.
Mm-hmm.
But the second hardest 5K I ever ran in my life, I prepped for. And I prepared for mentally, and I recovered, and it was a big effort from me. Neither were different on race day, but what it cost me was different. And I don't think we can overlook the mental side for the average person of what it, the toll it takes on you to be training with that race as your calendar header. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Weren't you like roofing all day or something? That one 5K? Something ridiculous.
That was a mile. That was a different one.
Oh, my bad. Trying to keep them all straight for you.
I've jumped into a lot of races is the point, though. And I've raced hard in them, but they don't cost me the same as putting it as this culminates my training block. It's weightier.
Well, you bring up a good point, actually, that I don't even know if I was going to, I don't know if I would have taken it there, but you said, oh, this race isn't important to me, but I still show up and run my hardest. I think there is a misconception like, oh, this isn't an A race. Some of these, when these guys talk about what's an A race or a B race or a C race, races that aren't the A race, I think people could misconstrue that and say, oh, I go out there and I also don't run my hardest, right? And I think that's very rarely the case where you toe a start line and then sandbag it, so to speak, for the sake of progression. What Bracken's outlining is maybe he normally does a 75-minute midweek long run on Thursdays when he's normally training. Well, instead of cutting that down, he goes and does 75 minutes on Thursday and his strength work. And then on Friday, he still runs 6 miles because that's what he would do before his Saturday long run. But then on Saturday, instead of the long run, he shows up in races. So nothing changes. He hasn't compromised his progression or his volume or taken away training time for that race. Maybe a little deload the week or two, or the day or two prior. But he's not outlining like, oh, it's not an A race, so I can't race all out. You absolutely can toe the line and race all out. You're just not setting yourself up to most likely be able to access everything you have available that day. And that's okay. That's just training through, which a lot of these high-end athletes we watch on YouTube or Peacock are doing the exact same thing in early season. Two big workouts that week, and they race Saturday. It's like, holy smokes. Yeah, I know, but what I care about's in a month. So I will back off the throttle before that, soak up all my training, and be fresh and fit when the start line comes. So I just think it's an important talking point about the you can still race hard, even if it's not an A race and it's part of the progression.
Yeah. Yeah. And the example to that is two of my more memorable stadium races from the OCR side were done at Citi Field. And one of them, I was living in Colorado and I was really trying to hit mileage and vert. And so I was trying to hit 70 miles per week with vert. And coming into this race, I got up and I ran 5 miles before my flight. I landed, met up with a friend, and did a 5 mile shakeout at like 8:30 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
That's not something I'm doing in order to do well at the race. That's something I'm doing in order to do well at training. So I got 10 miles in the day before the race, went out there, felt sluggish the first 1,200 meters of the race, got into a rhythm, and just poured my heart out and raced really hard. Finished, went home, ate, took a nap, came back, and raced again at tempo effort. So I could do another mile warm-up, get a 3 mile run, 1 mile cool down. I've got my 10 for the day. That's not a race weekend where that's an A goal race, but it didn't change the fact that I emptied my tank in the race. But then fast forward the next year, that was the most meaningful race of my year. And I did my last quality workout Tuesday. I did an easy set of strides Thursday, Friday. I barely moved, just shook out a little bit. And then Saturday emptied the tank. That's the difference between the same venue, the same race, and two different approaches to it. But my effort level did not change one bit.
Yeah, and the race itself. And not to misconstrue, like you can go have a race that isn't that important to you necessarily. You're training through it, and you can go run the best race of your life. Like I've done it. Like this is a full training week,
yeah.
And still you can still run well. So don't. It's not like you're setting yourself up to go out there and suck. It's just like just another Saturday, just another Tuesday. But I don't want to detract. I wanted to just talk that out for a second because I'm glad you brought that up about racing hard. How about this? I'm going to outline what I think is the best year. Like this is my own personal bias, athlete bias, coaching gatherings from our athletes over the years. And then I want to hear what you have to say. So I still think that two down weeks a year, I'll preach that to no end. I think two-ish down weeks a year are really important. And then my picking your spot is important as well. So maybe you do this. You base train-ish without much racing, let's say for 2 months, December, January-ish, maybe. January, February, whatever it is. You race yourself once-ish a month through like March, April, May. Pick something real big or important to you midsummer. There's a lot of offerings. Bam, go out with a bang. Take a little bit of a reset, build back up for even that second build can be shorter, 4 to 6 weeks. And then race yourself through the fall and then end again sometime in October, November with another thing you really care about. Bang, take your reset, start your build again for the following year. Big picture, talking 10,000 foot view. It's like 6 to 8 weeks of just not racing and getting time in, getting the groove. Race, 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 smack it, with a big one, restart the cycle. In an ideal world, it's not like that's how it always goes, but if I had my way, I think that would be a really nice way to just look at a year as a whole without getting too detailed yet. What about you? What do you prefer?
Well, I like that. And I like to do it a little more frequently now.
Do what more frequently?
The blocks with the deloads. I now like 3 to 4 of those a year.
Okay.
Some people are either going to hear that and say yes, or they're going to hear that and think that's too much commitment to one season. I don't want to do that. I don't want to think about it for that long. You're one or the other, or you're at a stage of life where it's one or the other. So then the opposite is you pick 3 or 4 of those and do compressed versions for each one.
Sure.
You don't need quite the deload after, but you don't have quite the attention span leading up to it. I think that that works really well for seasons or for marathons. And the other one works really well for keeping things fresh. I'm going to build for a spring marathon to get me through the off season of volume. Then I'm going to go after something mountain in summer. And then in fall, I might run a half or go after a 5K or maybe another marathon, but breaking up the season just a little more. But it's the same premise, right? You have your capstone on your block. And then along the way, you're going to build a progression of running and workouts that stack on each other. But you get to insert in races on the weekends anytime you feel like the block's getting old, or I want to try something out, or I want to see how the speed works working. The best workout is a race in terms of actually moving your fitness needle. You get to throw them in whenever you want.
Yeah, they can be part of that process. So let's say this then. I want to propose a question to you. So let's say you have a big race that you care about, and you want to perform your best. Let's say it is a marathon or a half marathon. That is your race. It's June 1st. Let's say June 1st, nice and clean.
Mm-hmm.
If you could pick your races up to June 1st as prep for the big dance, your A race, the half marathon on June 1st, the trail race, whatever it is, what would be your ideal race schedule leading up into that to have you ready on race day? What do you think?
I think that probably once a month leading up to it, once every 3 to 4 weeks, I would like to hit either a road 5K or a trail 10 to 15K. I think those two would balance out really nicely. I would want the over race burn of a 5K, like over speed. It's faster than what I'm going to use on, not truly over speed, but it's faster than race day. 5Ks hurt so badly, but if you're not training specifically for them and you can't totally get everything out of yourself, you're not going to set yourself back too far. And they hurt so bad that if you're not in a fight, it's hard to really kill yourself. You can get close and then you fade a little bit. So I think it's something you can recover from if you're not at the highest level. And then that trail 10 to 15K, it's easier to modulate, not just redlining the whole time. And you get a feel for pace and work, but it's softer on your body, but it's a good long endurance day. So that's what I would do probably once every 3 to 4 weeks along the way to that half marathon.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, actually. That's beautiful. I think two races before, maybe three, start with something longer and grindy, something that might even take you longer than the race itself. The trails would be great. Go hit some local trail race or some, I don't even know what it might be, right? And then maybe go find a 10K a month later and then find a 5K a month after that and a month out from your half. Everything's shorter and stingy. You're still keeping your long runs, your big training blocks, but anything that's going to make race day feel relaxed. And then at race day. I mean, you just saw Josh Kerr open his season with a half marathon. The guy's a mile world champion. Talk about, they start big and they whittle down, right? And then they get faster than race pace usually at the very culmination. And then they race to feel comfortable, right? That's the idea. And so, yeah, I agree with that. Start something big, something longer, maybe just works on your stay power, your durability, and then sort of whittle down the race distance before your A race.
But what you didn't hear me say is run a road race, a 10K or a 10 miler. I do not like running just one deviation or two shorter than race distance for long distance road racing. I think for the track, it makes a lot of sense. I do not like it on the roads. It is too depressing. I'm running a half marathon. I should be able to run 6 weeks out, 10 miles at my goal pace. It's not the way it works. You're going to feel like crap most of the time. And the whole time you're going to think, how am I ever going to hold this for 3 more miles? You're going to run a 10K, which is essentially half the distance of a half marathon. And you're going to, it's less than half the distance. And you're going to think, how am I ever going to double that distance? It's going to depress you 9 times out of 10. So run a 5K. It's so much shorter that it's not the same. And if you want to run longer, that's why I say the trails, because you won't have a one-to-one comparison that's going to set you back mentally. You're going to get a great effort and you're going to know, it doesn't really tell me anything about time, but I know what I can do effort-wise.
Yeah, I think half is my limit. Like, I'm going to race, and you'll see a lot, and I wouldn't even do this. You know, the marathon, I wouldn't want to run a half before the marathon. I'd go 10K or under.
Nope.
A lot of guys do run a half, like 4 to 6 weeks out, which is interesting to me, yeah, because I think that would, you see it often, actually. And I think that that's a tough route to go for me personally. But I think half the race distance, with the exception of the marathon, for me is like where I'm like, okay, you could justify that as over speed racing. And you'd hope that the half would feel more comfortable mm-hmm. than the 10K, notably, but who knows, right? But it is a fine yeah. line. Yeah.
Yeah. And racing should be enjoyable if it's not an A race. So yeah. I wouldn't want to do a B race that leaves me in shambles.
I also find something, I know we want to get dialed in on pacing if you're on the roads. And if you're on the mountains and you're racing trail or OCR, you want to get dialed in there. But there is some damn power to doing the exact opposite of whatever you're training for. And I would find a way to do that. So let's say you got a big mountain race. 5K would be perfect for you. Oh my God, go hit a 5K on the road, burn the pointy end of your spear, and perspectively, it's going to make your mountain race feel more approachable. And the opposite, you got a 5K road race you're training for, there's a lot of value in 4 or 6 weeks out going and hitting a trail 10 miler even, which I know sounds like it's so different, but for some reason, that back and forth for me like really works. Just like do something so left field that it may not even feel like it'll translate, but it's a different enough to shake a little bit. For me, that seems to work. You ever notice that?
For sure. I think training is for building running economy, efficiency, sustainability. And I think racing is for shaking it up and building a comparison with a non-like effort. Like your half marathon or your marathon, you're going to build the ability to stay at that stride all day in training. Mm-hmm. Your races don't need to work on that. They need to work on making half marathon feel easier. And a 10 miler won't make a half marathon feel easier. It's just not. It's too similar. A 5K will. A 5K, you're going to feel like a stride reduction moving to a half marathon.
Giving you lots to think about, folks. So how about this? Let's mm-hmm. go both opposite ends of the spectrum. One, I think, is going to speak to less people, and then the latter is going to speak to more, but the infrequent racer. I raced 6 times last year. That's it. And 2 of those races were on the same weekend. That's it. And you know what? I nailed almost everything. I didn't need a bunch of lead-up races. My training did what it needed to do. I showed up pretty ready. Like, I was happy with my performances across the board. I didn't show up to one and lay an egg. And really, that's 5 separate race weekends or races, right? One was a back-to-back Spartan race in SoCal to start the year, a couple of 5Ks, a couple of trail races. Voila, here I'm at. Okay, so it's possible to race well if, like, hey, I'm not available all the time, or I'm not going to race all the time. What do you think it's possible? What I'm kicking to you is to race your best if you're a, I'm gonna pick one big race or 2 big races a year, and that's what I work toward. Are you leaving anything on the table by not racing into the lead-in? What is your thoughts on that? For me, the answer is I don't know, because I won't know. But I was able to race well racing infrequently because I feel like I understood my lead. What are your thoughts on infrequent racing and still racing your best?
I think it can work perfectly fine, but there are a few prerequisites there. The first is a history of racing. You were just talking, you ran hundreds of races in high school. We ran over 100 races in college. So between high school and college, I would guess you and I ran 250 to 300 track races, minimum.
So many races. Yeah.
We were undeveloped for a lot of them. We weren't necessarily good in a lot of them. We were out of shape for a lot of them, but it doesn't change the fact that those are like, we have 300 to 400 reps probably on the track and roads in our time to draw upon. So our tactics, we know it. Our effort ranges, whether you're in shape or out of shape, racing teaches you how to pace yourself. So we understand how to do that. It may not make us any good, but it means that we're able to get a lot out of our engines. Like someone asked me a great question the other day, and this is not what we'll get into, but they said, if you could redo any race in your life with what you know now, or to erase a mistake or anything like that, and I could only come up with like 3 or 4 races because I haven't laid a lot of duds. I get a lot out of my fitness. I'm either do well or I get beat by people who are just flat out better than me.
which happens a lot. But there's not often a lot of things that I look back and say, oh, I could have changed so much. There's a few of them for sure, but we get a lot out of ourselves because we've run a lot of races. We know what to do. So if you have a big body of work, I don't think you have to race very frequently. In fact, every year someone comes out and sets a track world record on their first race of the year, or a national record, or a PR. The other caveat is, what kind of race is it going to be? The shorter the race, the more chance of tactics needing to play into it, the bigger the crowd, the more you should have a tune-up race or two just to get a feel for it again. But getting out for a 30K on the trails, that can be your first race in 2 years, and you're going to do fine if you have a racing history. It's kind of a long answer, but I think if you do not have a racing history, you should race more frequently and build up your racing history. It's like anything else you do. The more often you practice that skill, the better you're going to get it.
Could not agree more again, Bracken. I do think...
Look at us.
Oh, we're so cute. The longer the race, the more likely your fitness is going to show through regardless, right? So if you're running long races, and you want to race long races less frequently anyways due to the recovery and damage afterwards, right? And so I think if you're going and racing like a 50K on the trails, by all means, like, you could go every 6 months and hit your 150K, and I think you're going to get yourself where you need to go. It's going to show through. You're going to be stripped down to your fitness. Maybe you could go in with a little more fitness if you race something beforehand, possibly. But I think it'll show through. I think where stuff's left on the table, and I felt this in my 5Ks on the track this summer, was like the shorter and spicier stuff, the stuff that you really got to start splitting hairs in seconds, I think needs a little more exposure. And maybe, I don't know what that threshold is for most. I think for me, it'd probably even be like a 10K and down at this point still, where it'd be like, hey, I don't think I can just show up and run my best 5K crack one. I really don't. I think I need to expose myself to some sort of variation of that, whether it's a 5K itself or even racing down to a mile or mile time trialing or doing something or feeling it out. I just think the shorter the race, which almost would seem counterintuitive, the shorter the race, the more lead in, I think, opportunities you need. There's less margin of error.
Yeah.
And in the longer, I think it's less.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that wholeheartedly. And then my final caveat to that is how much can go wrong in your race that you have to just feel and learn something. You know, it's let's say like an OCR race. I think you got to tune up for an OCR race. I really think you do. You have to feel what it feels to come off a carry, to come off a crawl, to hit some slop. You can do that all in a sim. That's fine. A lot of these things you can do in training, but training races, a simulation or a local race, but you got to feel it. I think High Rocks is the same way. You can be very successful, but you're never going to get your pacing right. Like, I look at someone like Augie, who you work with. I don't know anything you're doing, but he came out and ran a great first High Rocks. And then he just won his age group at North American Champs. Did I see that? Was he the age group champ?
This age group North American champ. Yeah,
yeah. Killed it. It's fantastic. He had two wins and two successful races. And I would wager that he's nowhere near his optimal pacing strategy yet.
Yeah.
And
truth be told, with him, we gave him 5 weeks lead in with purposeful work, right? We built foundation and gave even more so. Yeah. He's got room to improve just based on exposure. But yes, continue. Sorry.
Yeah. So you can have success, but you won't hit your ceiling. We're in, let's say a trail 50K or a marathon. If you nail your training and you execute well on race day, you can get pretty darn close to a lifetime PR.
Mm-hmm.
You may set your lifetime PR. A marathon, oftentimes we don't hit it just right, but if you're dialed in enough with your training, you can go out at a pretty much the correct pace. A race where you got to learn something, a highly technical ultra that you've only run smooth, some of those things you just got to get done out of the way and learn what you didn't know and then put together a training block.
Yeah. Yeah, the nuances of it are fun, because I think there's, like, you know, many ways to skin the cat, so to speak, which I still think is a weird phrase, but like, you can get to the same place multiple ways, depending on where you're at in your running journey. Like you said, like, how tenured are you or untenured? I think one of the best things somebody can do who's pretty new to this is get yourself consistent for 3 to 6 months and then go race every weekend for 2 months and then like start over. Like, you, maybe I'm being a little exaggeratory there, but you're right. If you're new to it, exposure is important, but if you're a veteran to things, that would actually be the wrong formula for you. So it's like, it's still nuanced, but I think there's principles we're just trying to get across.
Yeah, what's your racing history? What skill set do you bring? And then adjust from there. I have a question, though, before we move on.
Yes, sir.
You're the son of a taxidermist. I'm the son of a hunter. He doesn't hunt anymore, but he was a hunter. I've skinned
both
an animal.
Their names are Pete.
You are a hunter. You've skinned... They're both named Pete. I've skinned one deer in my life. You've skinned many deer. I can't imagine the tail of the cat adds a whole lot into the equation. Is that just a false statement that there's many, like there are many bad ways, wrong ways to skin a cat, but there's really like, really only one or two good, efficient ways to skin an animal, correct?
I mean, yeah, we could get down. I can think of three approaches to skinning a cat off the top of my head.
Three.
So I don't, is that many ways to skin a cat? I mean, do we want to dissect this right now? Yeah, well, I don't like thinking about that in cats anyway.
I don't think we need to dissect the cat at all, but it's just a weird animal to choose. And it's also a weird activity to choose that there's kind of just an accepted best way or two, maybe three, to skin an animal. And everyone uses it.
I agree. There's a lot wrong with that adage, and I don't know where it came from. So we'll look it up.
Someone will reach out to us. Someone will let us know. Probably from Appalachia, and that's okay.
I could get detailed with this, and I could really start describing, I think, what is the best approach, but I think we'll save that. Just like we're sort of describing the best approach to skinning the racing cat, we'll call it. But tangent. Oh, opposite end of the spectrum. So the over-racer, or what we would consider, right? Okay, so now we're going to look at the other, like the ones who wanna, gonna, gotta, need to, I don't care, I wanna. Which I understand. And I don't know about you, and you know who you are. I'm not going to say your names. I've probably got half a dozen of these I'm working with right now. The ones just like, fine, your race list is 26 deep and I'll just tolerate it and do my best. And you're going to do your best and whatever. So let's just talk about that. Can you race your best truly? Do you feel like if it's done right, can you still go reach your potential on a very frequent race schedule? Let's say 20 race a year schedule. What do you think?
I won't say no, because there are people who just do a crazy amount of work or races, and from time to time, they just catch lightning in a bottle. Because engine is engine, and we preach that on here, and work is work, and races are fantastic stimulus for training. Fantastic. They're just hard to recover from, and they're hard to keep part of a progressive nature of training. But it doesn't negate the fact that you're putting in a ton of work, and sometimes you'll just pop one. And that pop may be as good as anything you could have built up going progressive overload for years. I'm not going to say no, but it's hard to predict. And that's the thing about boring vanilla training, is that it's really easy to predict and relatively easy to control. So you shouldn't count on it because you don't know when it's coming.
We haven't been more in sync, I think, in an episode for quite some time. I'm just like nodding my head with everything you say. It's a beautiful thing.
It just pumps me up. As I see your visual feedback as I'm talking, yeah. I get a little thrill of achievement.
Can you tell that I'm liking what you're saying sometimes? Like, can you visually see? I'm like, oh yeah, this is good stuff.
Sometimes the eyebrows will go up, and other times you'll get this, like, you got a mustache now, so it accentuates that like satisfied nod you give me. Like, if you want someone to just nod at you, it's a man in a mustache.
That is true. That is true. I'm also trying to send you subliminal messages with a wink every once in a while. I don't know if it's working for you, but I agree with you.
There's a little delay.
I agree with you. I think I'm going to say objectively, yes, I think you can run your best you can. I think your PR could be roughly the same. Let's say it's a 5K when the year's all said and done. I actually do. But you're going to hit the doldrums at points. You're going to have a streak of real bad stuff happen. Like, you're going to show up with nothing for multiple races in a row. You're going to bang your head against the wall and be like, I ran so well 6 weeks ago, and now I'm a pathetic version of myself who's always tired. And you're not going to be able to predict when or where or why or how it's going to happen nearly as well as with a well-thought-out lead-in and then race, a race, so to speak. So you might end up with the same numbers on the board, maybe. But I think you're going to be able to do it less often when it's all said and done. And I think you're going to hit these low points every year where it's just bad race after bad race because you just fried. And then you're going to have to do some hard looking in the mirror, and then you're going to end up racing less the next year, which just happens to everybody who races too much generally, is they'll be like, I'm getting worse, and I'm racing all the time, and I'm training so hard. But I still think the number at the end of the year might be close to the same P PR. It's just going to be a little messier in route and after. That's what I think.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's just so hard to quantify. One of the pieces of night school with this threshold training course that we have coming up is we're going to be talking about how you quantify like the training expenditure versus the return on investment. It's going to be like a spreadsheet chat for a while. There's going to be a lot of analogies during this because it's the easiest way to simplify a complicated concept. But when you apply that to racing, part of the reason that threshold training is so great is you can really quantify what it's costing you and what you're getting back out of it. Racing is so difficult to quantify the expenditure and to quantify the recovery and what you get back because you're just going by feel. If I give you 10x3-minute interval session, we know you're ready to go again 48 hours later. We know that. Worst case, it's 72. I give you a 10-mile trail race. We're guessing when you're going to be fully ready to work hard again, and we're guessing at what you really got out of it. We know there was something. We know it was good. We know there's a recovery cost, but it's really hard to balance that spreadsheet appropriately. So the only way to ensure progression is to undershoot throughout your week with your intensity and volume. And the only way to feel like you're working hard is to risk overshooting throughout the week. So there's just more guesswork with it. And if you can't quantifiably balance your spreadsheet and training, you can't quantifiably predict accurately when you're going to be at your best. So for people that don't care about that, it's a great way to get fit. For people who want some semblance of normalcy or trackability of your fitness or predictability, it's just not for you.
It's like being in the good old days when you don't realize it's the good old days with your racing. You're going to go race a bunch. You're going to hit a bunch of races. You'll be like, things are going really well. I'm fit right now. And you're like, and then a month and a half down the line, when you had a few performances you're not pumped about or your legs were lead for whatever reason, you look back and be like, May was the good old days. Like it was then. That was where I was peaking and I didn't even know it. But you only know in hindsight. You only look back and be like, that was it. That was my ceiling for this time period. And that's the... It can be wonderful when you're in it. You don't even know you're in it. You think you're just going to go to the moon, right? With your fitness, you're just the man or the woman. Right. You're just clicking, right? I'm dominating. I've had 3 great races in a row. And then you look back slowly over your shoulder months later and sigh. That was it. And it's a beautiful thing. It's just, it's not sustainable and it's not predictable.
No.
Yeah.
And races are very confusing creatures. When you're on the track, you know exactly what went well and what went wrong, and the time tells you exactly how successful it was. When you get to the road, it's the same thing, but a little bit muddled. And then you get to the trails or the mountains or hybrid or OCR, and now your finish can have almost no bearing on how the race went. There are so many times I ended up on a podium or holding a check, having run a crappy race because someone fails something. Or it's super muddy and people can't use their fitness, but it didn't quantify my fitness or what I did on that day. And so since most of us don't run track races and half of us run road races, the vast majority of us can't really quantify exactly what the race even means if it's successful, much less if it's unsuccessful. So it's just, again, I know that we're driving this point home, but the more you race, the less you know about your fitness if training is interrupted by it.
That's a good point and a good bow tie on that bit of the conversation. I have one last question I want to ask you, and then we're going to wrap this thing up. And that is, do time trials count as races? Do you think that time trials, as important as we think they are, do you think that, hey, I'm not racing that often, but I'm going to time trial en route to my race, or I'm going to, you know, hit things on my own? What do you think? Do you think time trials qualify?
For most people, no. I think they count as really hard workouts. I think there are a certain type of person, and I think I might lump you into this, that can crush themselves in a time trial, at which point you have to respect it like a race, yes. But anytime it's a solo effort, unless you're planning on racing solo, I don't think it counts as race experience. I do not. It is really, really difficult to run even the same stride for a lot of people, solo versus in a pack. Your heart rate reacts differently. You don't get as much out of it. There's no incentive for people to close it down the last 10% of the race. So for most people, it's a workout. albeit a big one. For the rare individual, yeah, you gotta respect it as a race.
I think I agree with your first sentiment. I don't think it is. I don't think most people, and I actually put myself in this boat, maybe you don't, but
okay.
I felt very different racing 5K on the track than I would time trialing anything on my own, like objectively, now that you feel it and the aftermath, the recovery process. I'm going to say no. I'm going to say that's a purposeful part of your build up, but it doesn't replace. If you need to race to race your best in an A race, I don't think it does. General rule of thumb. I think you're right. There's still some exceptions out there that might time trial better than they race because of whatever lack of nerves and able to control themselves. Like there's a whole individual type there, but I'm going to say no, not the same.
Okay. I think the only ones that I would oftentimes count as races are longer FKTs, something that you build it up like a race. You're having your race breakfast. You have to approach it like a race, and something about it being an FKT, a time standard that's going to be posted public, gets you a little further into the cave. And if it's long enough, any that I've gone after, I've ended up destroying myself to race level. That would probably be my only one where I'd say, yeah, we need to count that as a race, a long FKT.
Yeah, I agree. Like, let's say you went out and did 38 miles for your 38th birthday. Like, whether you went and did that in quotes easy or raced it, like, yeah. End result's going to be the same damage, right? Structurally. And then you're going to have to recover and maybe adapt from that. But I agree. Normal traditional race distance. Yeah.
Ran Pikes Peak solo. I'm trash for a week. Doesn't matter that it wasn't a race.
Rim to rim, which you've been meaning to hit, still is you're lusting after, for example.
Yeah.
Rim to rim to rim.
Yep.
I think you were just rim to rim.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not. I mean, I'm a little different, but I'm not crazy.
A double rimming. Why don't you plug your night school real quick, and then let's end this thing.
Yeah, night school's coming up now. We're about, 2.5 weeks away?
Mm-hmm.
Spots are filling up fast, and once again, this is going to be for anyone. If you are self-coached, if you are a coach, if you're just interested in understanding the topic of threshold training a little better, this is the course for you. In my opinion, there are two types of learning, and all of this is coming out because I was a teacher and I still kind of yearn for that situation. I really like that part of speaking, of giving information out, but in a collaborative environment. This is not, you and I collaborate, but it's not collaborative with the listener. And mm-hmm. So as a result, you can't adapt the information as it goes to make sure people are understanding it. Night school will be that thing, but there's two ways to get information. There's the way so that you can have access to it on the day you need it, in a one-time off situation, like for a test or an exam. And then there's the type that you can recall it for the rest of your life, where someone says, what does a red light mean? You always know it means you need to stop. Where if someone asks you like what the protocol for yielding is at a three-way intersection, you might have to brush up on that. You may not remember it. This course is designed to be the one that you remember for the rest of your life. For most of you listening, if I said define anaerobic threshold, there'd be some, as Kirk would say, hemming and hawing. It's the kind of thing that you would look up. If I want, what's the best style of training for threshold? Well, what threshold are we talking and how is that going to vary? What is my exact working definition of lactate threshold, anaerobic threshold? Are the two the same or are they different? How does that work with ventilatory threshold two? Which of the two of those are the same and one's close to that? There's always that little bit of uncertainty. And then how do I apply it? What is the time domain I need to work in? This course is designed so that you just have that at the top of your head for the rest of your life. You don't have to look it up anymore. You have a grasp of it, an understanding. And so there's going to be a lot of stories and analogies, which I use because I was a special needs teacher and because memorization is not the strength of a student with a disability, but making it correlate to something they already understand was what I did all day long. And I'm fairly certain that's why I still use silly analogies because you may not remember threshold training, but you'll remember standing naked in a doorway, right? That thing sticks and then it helps you understand. So that's what this course is designed to do. It's going to help you retain the ability to be fluent on threshold training. And it's going to take the single most popular style of training today, which is double threshold training, and break it down to a level that you understand and then can apply to any sort of athlete, whether it's you or someone else in any sort of situation. It's going to make it practical and available to you. So if that is worth $99 over the course of 4 weeks to you, then don't hesitate. Let's just sign up.
Well, twist my arm, Bracken. I'm signing up. I've had two people tell me that you're undercharging, that we are undercharging.
Oh, we are. For sure.
Yeah, $100 is too cheap for what we're going to be offering. So take that for what it is. But you need to go to therunningpublic.com. You need to click on Night School. You need to click buy or subscribe or whatever it says on the little clicky button. And then I also, and when does that start, I guess? What's the start date on that? Wednesday, March what?
March 20th runs every Wednesday night for an hour and a half at 6 p.m. Central Time. And it goes for 4 weeks. And to be clear, this is a question we keep getting. The video will be recorded as well as our interactions with the people who are taking the course afterwards and sent out immediately after. So if you end up missing a session or having to leave early, you don't miss out on anything. You'll get it all.
Well, I was just going to rub into the listener's face that I get to see. I get to see your face every week for free, but those suckers got to pay for it. And maybe mine too.
Got to pay to play, Kirk.
You do. And then I'm just going to make a plug for our personal coaching, which we don't do very often, but it's March. It's early March. You got things you care about and you feel like you're not maybe on the right track at this point, or you could use a little guidance as things get closer, like reach out to us, either Instagram, personal emails. I think there's an inquiry button on our website. Reach out. Now's a great time to get started if you've been dabbling in your running but not super focused and you realize races are looming this summer. Maybe you're not where you need to be. Like now's the time. If you haven't done it yet, you got to start. And so if you need a kick in the pants or the right program, like reach out to us personally. Now's the time. Shameless plug done. Anything else you want to add to that?
Go watch World Indoor. Also, the Tokyo Marathon happened. Worth watching. But watch some running races. There's no better way to get fired up about the sport that you take part in than by watching the best in the world do it.
Yep. I second that motion. Thanks for listening, folks. We'll see you later this week.